Good morning. Welcome to Mountain Money on a beautiful Monday morning, spring morning, heading to a high in the 50s today, I believe. 53 looks like the high. Then a bit of cold coming back tomorrow. This is Larry Warren along with Doug Wells, and this is Mountain Money. And thanks for joining us this morning. We've got a really good show. We're starting off with Simon Sinek, who is the author of Leaders Eat Last, Why Some Teams Pull Together and Others Don't. This is a book on leadership, and there are a lot of leadership books out there. But let me tell you, this one is different. And I watched Simon's TED Talk last night online, and Doug, he has like 12 or 15 million views.
That's a lot of views.
Of his TED Talk. So he has some interesting things to say that appear to resonate with listeners.
And if you're driving to work and wondering why Mountain Money is on the air at 8 a.m., it's because you forgot to put your clocks forward. So pull over and change your car's clock. Our second guest is going to be Clint Probst. He is the funeral director and owner of Probst Family Funerals, which is a new funeral home in Midway. If you're planning on dying in the next 12 months, you'll want to listen in.
No one gets out of this alive.
That's right. And our final guest is Mike Mazzoni. He's the principal broker and owner of Park City Realty Group. He's going to give us an update on the Park City real estate market. Should be interesting. Larry, my thought is things are heating up here, but we'll find out from a professional what's really going on.
Exactly.
You're listening to Mountain Money on KPCW, and we'll be back in a minute. Please stay tuned.
Park City Realty Group is a proud sponsor of KPCW's Mountain Money. This is Mike Mazzoni, principal broker and owner of Park City Realty Group. 100% locally owned and operated, Park City Realty Group provides boutique real estate services to buyers and sellers in the area. 649-1991 or parkcityrealtygroup.com.
This is Ryan Hoffman, branch manager at Mountain West Bank.
And Brooks Harbertson, commercial lender, sponsor of Mountain Money on KPCW.
We offer several products and services for individuals and businesses, including deposit and loan solutions.
Mountain West Bank, Kearns Boulevard, next to the theater, 649-3369.
Division of Glacier Bank, member FDIC, equal housing lender.
Welcome back to Mountain Money, and we have on the line with us from New York City, Simon Sinek. Interesting name, Simon, since your book jacket describes you as an unshakable optimist with a name like Sinek. Welcome to Mountain Money.
Nice to be here. Thanks for having me.
Well, your book is Leaders Eat Last, and this is a follow-up to your first book, which was a big bestseller and had you running all over the country speaking about it, and that book was Start With Why. So let's just start this discussion with the takeaway from Start With Why, which was the circle of or the golden circle, I guess,
yeah,
is what you'd call it, of leadership. Just
yes.
Briefly talk about that.
Sure. Start With Why was born out of a very real problem I suffered myself, which is I lost my passion for what I was doing. And people gave me silly advice like, do what you love. The problem is I was doing the same thing and I didn't love it anymore. And so in the course of trying to rediscover my own passion, I made a discovery. That every single organization on the planet, even our own careers, always functions on the same three levels. What we do, how we do it, and why we do it. I call this the golden circle. Every single one of us knows what we do. These are the products we sell, the services we offer, the jobs we perform. Some of us know how we do what we do. These are the things that we think make us different or special or stand out from the crowd. It's the things we write on our resumes or, you know, offer in our sales pitches. But very, very few of us can clearly articulate why we do what we do. And by why, I don't mean to make money. That's a result. By why, I mean what's your purpose, what's your cause, what's your belief. Why does your company exist? Why do you get out of bed this morning, and why should anyone care? And I realized that for me to refine my passion, I needed to know all three of these pieces. And I knew what I did, and I knew how I did it, but I didn't know why. And I became absolutely obsessed with this thing called the why.
And so what did your new passion become?
Well, it's not a new passion. What I learned is that why I do what I do is to inspire people to do what inspires them, and together we'll change our world. So it doesn't matter what I do. I do many things. I teach, I write, I speak. You know, I used to have a career in marketing. That was still applied. You know, I wanted to create messages that inspired others to be a part of something bigger than themselves. Now, with a career as an author and a speaker and an advisor, I do the same things. And that's just the very point, which is it's not wise for us to define ourselves by what we do, because what we do is limited and limiting. When we know why we do what we do, we have tremendous flexibility to do other things. The amazing thing is I discovered that this pattern, this naturally occurring biological pattern that exists in biology, it's the way the brain functions, you can see it in other organizations. You can see it in great leaders. Martin Luther King was not the first person to understand what needed to change to bring about civil rights in our country, but he didn't go around telling people what we need to do, what we need to do, what we need to do. He went around and told people what we believe, what he believes, what he believes, and that's what inspired us. The reason Apple has unbelievable flexibility to go into so many different industries and have so many different products is because they don't define themselves by what they do. They don't see themselves as a computer company. They see themselves as a company that wants to challenge the status quo. And so that's given them the opportunity to challenge the status quo in small electronics, in phones, in computers, in all sorts of other industries. You know, other computer companies can make every single product that Apple makes, but we, for some reason, won't accept those products for them because we don't understand why Dell would make an MP3 player.
That why is what's interesting. Like you say, people will buy products from Apple when they're just as good a products coming from other companies, but we just don't have a passion for a Gateway or a Dell or a Hewlett-Packard. It's hard to get emotional about Hewlett-Packard, yet
right.
People love everything Apple puts in a white box.
You know,
if you are someone who thinks like Apple, yes. I mean, you know, marketers talk about creating an emotional connection, whatever that means. It doesn't mean making people cry, you know. But when we relate, when we feel that an organization or a human being believes what we believe, then we're more apt to make that quote unquote, that proverbial emotional connection.
Wow.
So that's what this is about.
And, you know, that brings up a really good point because, Larry, you just mentioned HP. And back 20 years ago when I was in business school, actually HP was a company that people loved. And so companies have to constantly work on that connection with people. And, Simon, that relates to the question I want to ask you, which is I liked your point about it's not what you want to do, but it's about who you are and about why you do it, and it has different ways of expressing itself. What advice do you have for people as they're thinking through what are different ways I could express my main goal, my main passion in life? How did you think about that, and what advice do you have for people that are struggling with that?
Well, I think the biggest lesson I learned was that is that I couldn't do it alone. You know, I think very often, especially if you're in a position of leadership, that we think we have to know all the answers, and if we don't, we think we have to pretend that we do. Very often we make the mistake, no matter what level we are in the organization, that our credibility comes from our intelligence or how much we know. And nothing could be further from the truth. Our credibility comes from our honesty. Our credibility comes from our willingness to sacrifice our own interests to help others. I mean, that's where it comes from. These are very basic human needs. And this is sort of where I pick up where the last book left off. In this new book, in Leaders Eat Last, is trying to understand what it actually means to be a leader, and what I learned was sort of remarkable. Again, I as is my nature, I sort of take a scientific approach to it, which is I'm not just interested in looking at case studies, and you know, there's plenty of books about you know what are the characteristics you have to have to be a leader, you know, and charisma, vision, you know, sure, but there's something more fundamental than that. These we're social animals. We live in groups, and fundamentally, leadership is necessary for our very survival. And if you go back 50,000 years to the dawn of man, you see the way that we evolved. You see how we're designed is to increase the likelihood that we'll succeed and survive. One of the things that we have the capacity for is leadership, and the closest definition I can give for what a leader actually is like a parent, right? Long before there were corporations, long before there were even nation states, all we had was the tribe, we had the family. And if you think about what a parent is, a parent commits their life to the life of another human being. you know, you'll have a better life if you don't have kids. You know, you can buy a nicer car, live in a bigger house, go on better vacations. You'll certainly get more sleep.
Please don't remind us all this.
But we sacrifice. We make this choice for some reason to make all of these sacrifices, to give up our life of freedom and prodigal ways, you know, to bring a child into this world. And over the course of that time, we see little glimmers that our sacrifice was worth it. And then eventually when our kid grows up and we see what they become, it's the most overwhelming feeling of goodness. And it was all worth it, right? Leadership is the same thing. Like parenting, we can't measure the effects of good leadership on a daily basis. You don't know if you're being a good parent or a bad parent on a daily basis, and you make mistakes along the way. It's cumulative. And you can easily see organizations that are well-led versus those that are poorly led because of the people's devotion to the organization and that leader. It's a good family.
And let's talk about the one example you have, which is the title of your book, Leaders Eat Last. And
yeah,
this goes back to the United States Marine Corps.
Right. The other branches of the military do it as well, but I just happened to learn it from the Marines. I was having a meeting with a general in the Marine Corps, Lieutenant General George Flynn, who actually wrote the foreword to the book, which I'm very grateful for. And I was sitting down with him when I just got to know him, and I asked him, what makes the Marines so much better? What makes them so good at what they do? And he looked at me and he said simply, officers eat last. And it's absolutely true. If you go to any chow hall, any base, anywhere in the world, what you'll see is the Marines line up for food in rank order. The most junior person eats first, and the most senior person eats last. No one tells them they have to do it, and it's not in any rule book. It's because of the way they view leadership. They view leadership not as a rank, but as a responsibility for the lives of others, just like a parent feeds their child before they feed themselves. And if you go out into the field, they do the same. And I heard a true story, which is I love. A group of Marines were in theater, and the leader of the group ate last, made sure his men ate first, and there was actually no food left for the leader. And they went back out into the field, and all of the men brought their leader some of their food, because that's what happens. When we trust and believe that our leaders would sacrifice for us, what we do is we make sure that we will take care of our leader, and we will sacrifice and ensure that their vision comes to life. It's called loyalty. It's called loyalty. But no people in any organization will ever give their loyalty, ever. They will never sacrifice for the good of the organization until they feel that their leader would sacrifice for them.
That's a great example. And it's also called the highly functioning team, right? And,
exactly.
And for folks that want to create a highly functioning team. First off, I think leadership is learned. There are people that are born with some qualities that help them with leadership. And you have a piece in your book that talks about a common mistake people make. I know I made it early in my career as well, which is kind of fostering this sense of urgency and maybe amplifying it for the team to get this everybody pulling in the same direction and working hard, working quickly to try to achieve the goal. And it sounds logical. The problem is it doesn't work. What does work? What should people do instead of doing that?
So very often companies use internal competition to try and drive performance. We pit ourselves against each other, right? And we create a sense of urgency. If you don't get this done, bad things will happen. If you don't make your numbers this year, you're going to get laid off. You know, we do all of these things. You know, sometimes they're formal and sometimes they're assumed, but they're there. The problem is it actually creates fear and anxiety, and it undermines the very notion of what a cooperative and successful team is. The reality is the best organizations, the best leaders, the best group, the best teams have a sense of longevity. Again, I use the parenting analogy. You know, are you a good parent if your two-year-old is the best two-year-old in the class, or do you accept that it's the raising of the child over the course of many years that will determine the child's success? It's the same thing for a team, which is some people have good days and some people have bad, and not every year is a winning year, and not every project is a winning project. The goal is not to necessarily grow the numbers. The goal is to grow the people. And when we focus on the growth of the people, the numbers will follow because the people take responsibility for the results. And this is a very common sort of oversight of many people in leadership positions. People in leadership positions falsely believe they're responsible for the results. It's not true. They're responsible for the people. The people are responsible for the results. You know, I love talking to CEOs and they put their hands on their hips and say, "We believe our customers are a priority." To which I usually respond, "Well, that means your employees are at least second." You know, the customer is not the CEO's responsibility. The employee is the CEO's responsibility, and the customer is the employee's responsibility. And when we take care of our people, like a parent, we offer them training, we offer them opportunity, we offer them chances to fail and not lose their job. You know, we offer them chances to try again, discipline them when necessary, all with the single goal that they will grow up and be able to achieve more than we could ever for ourselves, then they take responsibility. They want to make us proud. They want to prove to us that our sacrifice and our giving to them was worth it, and they give us their blood and tears.
You know, and it takes courage to do that, right? You just said, you know, give your people the chance
yes.
to fail. The challenge with that as the leader of the group is when your people fail, that's often a reflection of the leader as well. So the leader's capital within the organization goes down. So it does take courage. And, you know, I think a good example of folks that come in, create this high sense of urgency, everybody's got to pull together or there's going to be bad consequences. I think oftentimes private equity guys get labeled with that. And you have in your book an example, a gentleman's name I believe is Bob Chapman.
Yes.
Who bought a company but did it differently. Tell us Bob's story.
So Bob is a remarkable human being. He runs a $1.7 billion manufacturing company in St. Louis called Baffey Waymiller. And in 2008, I'll give you one of the stories. There's a few stories in the book about how remarkable Bob is as a leader. You know, Bob faces all the same challenges as any other large company, and he has bureaucracy like any other large company, et cetera, et cetera. But in 2008, the economy hit the skids, and Barry Waymiller lost 30% of their orders sort of very quickly, almost overnight. And for the first time in many years, they had a real financial crisis where they could no longer afford their labor pool. And as is customary in our modern day and age, we very often look to layoffs as a means to balance the books. The problem is that Bob doesn't believe in headcounts, and he doesn't believe in reducing headcounts. Bob believes in heart counts. And it's very hard to reduce a heart count. Bob also doesn't understand the idea. He doesn't understand the point of destroying someone's life, absolutely eviscerating, you know, their very livelihood just so that you can make the numbers for the year. You know, it doesn't compute for him. And so instead of layoffs, he absolutely refused to do layoffs. They implemented a furlough program where every single employee had to take mandatory 4 weeks of unpaid vacation. They could take it any time they wanted, and they did not have to take those weeks consecutively, everybody from CEO to secretary. The fantastic thing is how Bob announced the program. And he said to his people, "It's better that we should all suffer a little than any of us should have to suffer a lot." And morale went up. And this is just the thing. Bob was willing to make sacrifices for the good of his people. He refused to sacrifice his people for the good of himself. And this unfortunately is a novel idea in our modern day and age. Unfortunately, layoffs have become such a standard way of balancing the books. It's become normal. We don't even question it. The amazing thing is the concept of layoffs as a first round of a defense to make the numbers work has only existed since the 1980s. It actually didn't exist it wasn't very common prior to that. So it's a relatively new experience. And I would argue, and I make the argument in the book from a very scientific and biological perspective, that by doing that actually creates a sense of anxiety in the environment, in the culture, that ultimately will lead to the long-term demise of any organization.
Yeah, Simon, you know, I always think real-world examples are a great way in a brief radio interview to get across the point you make in the book. So just talk briefly. This comes from your TED Talk about Samuel Pierpont Langley, a name lost to history unless you're an aviation buff.
Right. So at the time that the Wright brothers were pioneering controlled manned flight, they weren't the only ones doing it. It was actually very popular that day. It was the equivalent of the dot-com boom. Everybody was sort of in on the game. You know, and the Wright brothers were unknown. But one person who was very well known at the time was a man by the name of Samuel Pierpont Langley. And he had what we would consider the recipe for success. If you think, what does it take to succeed? You know, you have to have sort of, you have to have popularity, and you have to have money, and you have to have connections, and all of these things. Well, Langley was very wealthy. He was very well connected. He knew all the senators and all the important people of the day. The New York Times followed him everywhere, so everybody knew Langley and rooted for Langley. He was very well funded, given $50,000 by the War Department, which was the precursor of the Department of Defense. And he hired literally the dream team. He hired the best engineers money could buy of the day. The problem was Langley was driven by self-interest. The problem was Langley wanted to be rich and famous. Often, far away in the middle of nowhere, you have the Wright brothers, Orville and Wilbur Wright, who had no money, who had no connections. The New York Times followed them around nowhere. But the difference is they had a dream. They believed if they could figure out this pioneered man, this controlled man flight thing, they would change the world. Were driven by a cause, not by some selfish interest. The people who were on their team weren't in it for the money. The people who were on their team believed in what they believed and volunteered. And this is what gave them the strength to go back failure after failure after failure. And it was the Wright brothers who succeeded where Samuel Pierpont Langley didn't, because those on his team wanted to see the return where the Wright brothers wanted to see the success. And amazingly, further proof that Langley was in it for the wrong reasons, just shortly after the Wright brothers succeeded, Langley actually quit. He didn't say, oh, good going, guys, now I'll improve upon your technology. He actually got out of the game.
You know, it's one of the things I like about your book is you have a number of really good examples. Another example you have in your book is about a very brave pilot who's flying a A-10 and providing cover for some of the troops on the ground. His name is Johnny Bravo.
Call sign Johnny Bravo.
I guess exactly. His nickname is call sign.
No pilot would have a name that cool in real life.
That would be good. Yeah.
The funny thing is little old ladies call him Jonathan.
There you go. But Park City has its own Johnny Bravo. His name's Ted McAleer. And if you'll bear with us, actually, Larry and I have talked about, you know, how can we get the audience to participate and to ask questions. And so I called up my friend Ted McAleer, who's a graduate of West Point. Told him I was reading this book where a lot of the examples are really through the military. Asked him if he'd read the book and call in with a question.
I love it.
We actually recorded his question. I'm going to play it for you now and then get your thoughts on his question. Here it is.
Sure.
Hi, Larry and Doug. This is Ted McAleer with a comment about Simon's book and then a question of sorts. The book's...
Oops, hold on. Technical difficulty.
Hi, Larry and Doug. This is Ted McAleer with a comment about Simon's book and then a question of sorts. The book struck a chord with me because as a former Army officer who spent 4 years in a leadership crucible called the United States Military Academy, the themes of the book really resonate with me. However, unlike many books on leadership, this didn't contain a pithy how-to guide. So the lessons of the book may be difficult for some people to put into practice. And I wonder if Simon were building a leadership curriculum or a leadership minor for a college, I wonder what 3 to 4 books he would recommend alongside of his own book. And does he have any plans actually to write a third book, which may actually be a bit more of a how-to guide?
Well, I'm proud that the book resonated with him, and he's right. I wrote a why book. I wrote the why the teams work and sort of a social commentary as to what's gone wrong and give some sort of broad context for why things work and why things don't. In terms of the how-to, there's a couple of really brilliant books that I would recommend that really are the yin and yang to my book, sort of the yin to my yang, if you will. The best one I can offer is a book called Turn the Ship Around by David Marquet, M-A-R-Q-U-E-T. Also a military book, David's experience on a nuclear-powered submarine, how everything he had learned about leadership and command and control basically went horribly wrong, and he had no choice but to give away authority to his crew, and it had remarkable effect. He started with the worst-rated crew in the entire United States submarine fleet, and by the end, he had the best-rated crew in United States naval history. And it's not just a simple turnaround story. It was the things he did actually allowed him to build more leaders, which is really the primary responsibility of any leader, which is to build more leaders. 9 out of the 14 officers aboard his ship went on to their own command. The average in the Navy is 2. It's really remarkable. And what I love about David's book, relevant to the question asked, which is it really is a step-by-step explanation of the things he tried and the things he did and the way he did things. It really sort of is the actionable version of what I write about. It's really wonderful. I give the theory and the philosophy, and he puts it into practice. My book explains why his stuff works. Love it, love it, love it. I would also recommend that people look into Barry Wehmiller, W-E-H-M-I-L-L-E-R, which is that the what I told you about with Bob Chapman. They have a remarkable set of curriculum themselves that they've just started sharing. They've developed it for their own company, but they've just started offering it to other leaders and other companies. And one of the classes that is simply amazing, I've gone through it, is a communications class where they actually teach. It's a 3-day intensive course where they teach us how to better communicate with each other, how to have confrontation, how to speak to each other so that we listen. It's sort of remarkable, and we forget that. As social animals, our capacity for communication is paramount. And most of the things that go wrong are usually miscommunications, misunderstandings. We get offended or you know, by something somebody says. And they teach it. It's leadership 101, if you will. And like I said, they've started teaching that curriculum outside of their company, which is such a gift to the rest of us.
We'll look into that. What was Wehmiller's first name again, please?
Bob Chapman, Barry Wehmiller is the name of the company.
Barry Wehmiller, okay.
And I'll offer really, really quickly one other book that's brilliant. It's called How to Talk to Kids, How to Talk So Kids Will Listen and Listen So Kids Will Talk by Adele Faber. How to Talk So Kids Will Listen. Even though it's a parenting book and it's about how to talk to children, it's one of the most profound leadership books in how to talk to anybody.
That's great. Thank you. That's a superb answer to Ted's question, and thank you to Ted for calling in with that question.
Our author has been Simon Sinek. The book is Leaders Eat Last, Why Some Teams Pull Together and Others Don't. Simon, thanks for joining us. Sure appreciate it.
Thanks for having me, and thanks for helping me spread the ideas.
Okay, and coming up next, we're going to talk about a couple of local businesses. One's in Midway. It's just opened a new funeral home in Midway, owned and operated by Clint Probst. And then we'll follow that up with a look at Park City real estate as the season draws to a close. And we'll have Mike Mazzoni in from Park City Realty.
As one season draws to a close. And another begins.
The winter season draws to a close. And we'll be back after this.
Hi, I'm Kelly from San Francisco Design, longtime supporter of KPCW. We provide a mix of European and mountain contemporary home furnishings for a unique Park City lifestyle. Our showrooms are in Park City and Salt Lake, and both offer complete design services. We're on the web at sanfrandesign.com.
This is Chris Robinson with Prudential Utah Real Estate, and we've been supporting KPCW since day one. Prudential Utah helps buyers and sellers with their home needs, whether it's a condo, single-family house, or undeveloped land. Our agents know our community and our local market. More information can be found at pru-utah.com.
Welcome back to Mountain Money. I enjoyed the conversation with Simon. You know, Larry, leadership is a topic that, for me, never gets old, right? I mean, it's something that we all work on, and we'll be working on it really our entire careers.
And it's a hard one to grasp, especially in read a dry book. But, you know, the real world examples, just looking at great leaders and what they do. is inspiring.
Absolutely. We're changing gears now. We're in studio with us now is Clint Probst. He is the funeral director and owner of Probst Family Funerals in Midway. Clint, welcome to the studio. Thank you for joining us.
Thank you. Thanks for having me on.
So I was talking to Larry, who lives in Midway, I believe, Larry,
yes.
Right? And he was
three blocks from the home, which used to be a nice little restaurant, but it couldn't stay in business.
Yeah,
and that's what I wanted to get to. You know, it really bugs me when you see a concept go out of business time in and time out. And, you know, one restaurant goes out of business, another person opens it. And what do they put in? A similar restaurant that goes out of business. What does the next person put in? A similar restaurant. And I think your strategy of, you know, we're going to change what this location does,
yeah.
Is a really good one. And as you were looking for where you wanted to put your location in the Heber Valley, how did you decide on your first location?
There was a couple things. And Larry, maybe I need to apologize for putting it there. But
Well, that's okay. It was closed more than it was open anyway.
Right. Well, there was a few things to look at. Both cities, Heber and Midway, they had a couple of codes there that required so many parking stalls for so many feet of assembly that you were going to have in a building. And the codes were written where you had to have at least 30 parking stalls or one parking stall for every 25 square feet of assembly. And as we looked around at different buildings and things, we come across that building used to be the Burgermeister for years and years growing up that was owned by some of the Probst, and it had been renovated time and time again. It actually
your family was an owner of that building?
Extended family, yes.
Okay.
But
half the people in Heber Valley, Doug, you need to understand, okay. Are named Probst.
I didn't know that. Okay.
Right? You know, going through the space, it just seemed to work. We had to do some things with the layout and stuff, and, you know, we didn't have to do very many drastic changes. It was throw up a couple of different walls. For me, it just made sense. It felt like home. I wanted to be back in the valley. I wanted to be, in Midway. Midway is nice. I really enjoy being over there. And, Heber has their funeral home that they've had for years and years and years. And, you know, it's tough trying to get people to come over to Midway because they really don't want to.
It's all of 2 miles away,
right? You know, and but it's new facilities. It just made sense to us.
Now, most people in the funeral business, their parents were in it, and their grandparents were in it. And how did you get into it? Are you from a long line of funeral proprietors?
It would have made it a lot easier to go into a place as third or fourth generation, but no. I guess my journey started out years ago. I had the chance to go to Mexico for a couple of years and was working with a family down there that lost a loved one. And it was the first time really in my life that I was actually around somebody that one moment they're there and the next moment they're gone. They're a little bit more traditional than we are here. They had the visitation in the home and things. And it just really stuck out in my mind of, wow, this is neat. This is, you can be a part of something that pays tribute to somebody. And when I come back home, the closest school at the time was in Mesa, and I started to date my wife. And before we left, I asked her to marry me in the Midway Cemetery there. Believe it or not, so
how romantic,
that guy, right? Yeah, but I grew up right down the road from it, so it kind of. I don't know. I spend a lot of time just driving past and things. But that's just wanted to do it. Just always felt like service was it for me, you know.
That's a great story. And when I was in high school, I had a buddy. I'm trying to remember his last name now. We called him Frankie Z. His last name started with Z. And most of my friends worked at the McDonald's or the Burger King for minimum wage. I worked at a more upscale restaurant, made a little bit more. But Frankie worked at a funeral home and made a lot more than minimum wage because, you know, some of the jobs he had to do were things that were, you know, initially people, you know, thought, ooh, I'm not sure I want to do that. I mean, it was simple jobs like maybe drive out to the airport to pick up a body, something like that. And what surprised me was through that experience, Frankie decided this was what he wanted to do with his life. And, you know, we're 16. Nobody knows what they want to do when they're 16.
So I would think especially you wouldn't want to do that.
Well, and so I asked Frankie. I'm like, you know, at first I admired him because, you know, I envied him because he knew what he wanted to do, yeah. Right? I mean, there's a lot of stress in your life when you're 16 trying to figure that out. And I asked him, I said, you know, what is it about this that you know, you're sure you want to do it? And his answer really surprised me. And he said that, you know, it's really more of a psychological job. And you're helping people with something that's very, very important to them. And he just found that very rewarding to play that role in somebody's life at a time when it was so important. And it completely changed my view of what that job is. What attracted you to it?
It was that. I mean, there's a lot of unknown a lot of unknown that goes on behind the scenes. But and so there was a lot of curiosity. But I went to school for psychology and then later went back for mortuary science. And so I really enjoyed working with people. And at that time, when they do experience a loss, you have the opportunity, if you do it right, to be involved in things that most people never ever get to see and experience things with family members. And there's a lot of deep gratitude that goes into that or that the family feels. And, you know, it's not just always a job because it's not that. It's the reward is really the way that you feel and the opportunity that you have to serve people. And that's what it was for me. It was just as I started out, got that feeling and said, wow, this is it. I want to keep doing this. And so that's – having a family-owned funeral home, hopefully I can do that for families that I know in that valley. And even here, you know, I mean, this is a community, and that's what I wanted to do was serve a community. I did this for years in Arizona, and you would see people that, you know, you would serve maybe every once in a great while, but we've had the chance to help a few families right now, and, you know, you see them almost weekly, you know, at the grocery store, things like
sure.
that. And
especially in a small town
and
Midway and Heber. We need to move on, and let me just ask you a final question, and that's trends in the business. I would imagine the biggest trend of the last, and now it's probably been 20 years, is cremation. A lot more people are opting out of the display of the body and all of that and simply getting cremated. Is a Heber Valley more traditional with viewings and so on?
I would say Utah in general. In Arizona, it was about 80% of families decided that cremation was the route to go. And, you know, it almost makes it more intimate in a sense because it's, you know, if you want to go see your loved one, it's just typically the family and then they have a memorial service somewhere afterwards where maybe they go scatter the cremated remains or do something at a funeral home or at a church or wherever, community center. So it is the trend. It is changing. And what we wanted to do is we wanted to come in, provide great facilities, great service at affordable prices. I mean, so that our whole thing was being able to serve everybody instead of pushing people out of the valley or out of these two counties to go find other resources available. We wanted to be able to serve everyone. But yes, that is the trend. I kind of got off topic there. That's what's going on. But Utah in general is just kind of a more traditional place.
And Larry, if I can, just a quick follow-up question to that. Yeah, I moved here in 2006. This is my home now. You know, when my wife and I, we don't talk about it often, but when we do say, you know, hey, what do you want done when you're no longer here? You know, I'd like to be buried here in Park City when the time comes. Hopefully that's a long way off. But I don't think there's a lot of options for me, right? I mean, I think, and you would know the rules.
Hard to get buried in this town.
I have to be a citizen of Park City proper in order to buy a burial plot at the Park City Cemetery. So somebody that lives here, what are your options if you do want to be buried?
You know, and I've heard it's sold out, so I don't know exactly what's going on over at the cemetery here.
What about outside of that cemetery? What are the other options?
Well, you could always if – if you decide to do the traditional route, some families decide to go with Heber City Cemetery that are from Park City because that is really the closest available.
Yeah.
You know, so Park City is an interesting place. Usually cemeteries purchase more property and expand, but from my understanding, they never did that. So what you see is what you have there.
Well, let's hope it's that we won't be visiting Clint anytime soon.
That's right.
And need to confront that issue. But it's Probst Family Funerals in Midway, right on the main street there. Clint, good luck with your business, and thanks for joining us.
I really appreciate it. Thank you very much.
Good luck to you.
Thanks.
And we'll be back to talk real estate with Mike Mazzoni after this.
This Green Earth asks, 55 degrees in February?
TV as population control?
Clean air in the Salt Lake Valley?
Are these questions on your mind, too?
All of this and more explained on This Green Earth.
Tune in Tuesdays at 9 a.m.
Brought to you by Jones Waldo Holbrook and McDonough,
Republic Services,
Vail Resorts,
Habitat for Humanity's Restore,
and Rocky Mountain Power.
This is Christian Bohr with the Park City Chamber Bureau. Did you know that by shopping locally, you're supporting trail maintenance, our free bus system, and the many wonderful cultural and recreational opportunities in our community? When you shop or dine in Summit County, those dollars stay right here in Summit County.
Welcome back.
The Park City Chamber Bureau is pleased to support KPCW's locally grown radio show, Mountain Money. Remember, keep it local, keep it PC. The Park City Chamber Bureau is a nonprofit organization.
Sorry, jumped the gun there. Welcome back to Mountain Money. We're in studios now with Mike Mazzoni, principal broker and owner of Park City Realty Group. And Mike, we just wanted to have you in to update us on the market. What's happening out there as all the winter buyers have cycled through?
They're still cycling through, Larry. And thank you, Larry. Thank you, Doug. We had I know Marcy and Carol Eagle were on a couple weeks ago giving a great presentation on the 2013 market, so I don't want to rehash their great presentation. But as far as 2014 goes, pending sales are up about 25% year to date, so wow. January 1 to March 1st with the, 443 pending sales. Hopefully they'll all get to a closing table, but pendings are good, and up 25% is great. And as far as sales go, year to date, we have about 238, with prices ranging from $85,000 for a two-bedroom in Colville to $12.5 million in Bald Eagle. So big numbers.
That's quite the spread.
It is quite the spread.
So is there, and logic would tell me there probably is, but I don't know the magnitude, a seasonality effect of this? Is Larry right? The ski season is really when most of the homes get sold here?
I really think, and I believe, and I have over the past few years, as we become a four-season market, if you will, I really don't have a great answer as to what's the busy selling season. I know we do a lot of showings in the winter months. You know, I'm meeting clients today at 4 o'clock, kind of, hey, I'm getting off the hill, you know, let's meet type of deal. And then they'll come back in the spring, summer, and fall and actually write the contract. But that said, I think as far as lookers, definitely in the winter. But I don't know if there's any stats to say when, you know, any given month more contracts are written than others.
Fair enough.
Now, you gave quite a healthy range there, mm-hmm. but the problem here is more there's not much in the low range, and the low range keeps moving higher. You know, yesterday's affordable house at 3,000 is now today's much less affordable house at 400.
Right, and I think as the ladies mentioned, anything under 700,000 is getting looked at very hard. You know, I also believe, and what I wanted to emphasize today was kind of the mood of the market. I think it's definitely changing to a more positive move. The sellers are happier. The buyers are more prepared. In fact, I had a call from a lender a couple of weeks ago on one of our listings that we had under contract with a buyer, and it was on a Saturday afternoon. And this was a listing in the 550 range, and he said, you know, Mike, I just want you to feel assured the buyer is very qualified, overqualified. In fact, he's buying below his means. So kind of a nice thing to hear, that buyers are not overextending and maybe have learned some lessons from some of the things we went through in the last few years.
But what neighborhoods are you showing young families?
Trailside neighborhood is, you know, very hot right now. Anything around the Trailside Elementary School, Ranch Place, Silver Springs has always been a, you know, a big family neighborhood. So, you know, the key is can we get our inventory levels up? And I believe it'll start to loosen up this summer, I hope.
And speaking of inventory, related to that is how many days it takes an average home to sell. And what are you seeing there?
Again, under $700,000, you might have an offer in a week. Just depends on the home, the size, the condition. In the Trailside neighborhood, there's a couple of subdivisions called Sun Meadow, Aspen Glen, Fieldstone Homes. You know, we see emails go out with brokers looking for those homes, particularly that, you know, hey, we have a young family, and they need to be sometimes under $500,000, and
right.
It's not a lot of choice and a real hard niche to fill. So, you know, so we do need listings, and I believe they'll come. I believe that at some point everybody's a seller, because either they're moving on or they're seeing their equity back on the table and they want to move it to something else. So they end up listing their property.
Is that the reason inventory is tight, is sellers are waiting for prices to rise more?
Yeah, I think it's a combination of that. And, you know, maybe they're just happy and content of where they want to be. They may not want to go through the lending process again, or, you know, it could be a variety of factors. I don't know that there's any,
sure,
any one reason why we're seeing
talk
less.
To us about the lending environment. So, you know, somebody's been in their job 5 years, yeah, they make good money, they've got a decent credit score. How hard is it for somebody like that, yeah, to get, I think the term in the industry is a jumbo mortgage, in order to buy one of the homes that is closer to $800,000 to $1 million?
Well, I think the key with that, Doug, as you know, is, you know, the kind of the threshold of great FICO scores now is like 720 and above. So, again, we're seeing the buyers come in with more skin in the game, if you will. I mean, we're seeing them come in with 20% down, sometimes 30%, and buying below their means. As far as the jumbo loans go, the interest rates, in fact, in some cases, I just heard a case where a buyer was borrowing an amount over the jumbo amount and was actually getting a lower rate, interest rate, from the bank, because the banks are starting to loosen up and wanting to lend more money,
sure,
higher
just as
loan
much
amounts.
Work to approve the loan, and if they could put more money to work, they
right.
can amortize that fixed cost over more dollars.
Exactly.
Interesting. And where does the jumbo start now? Is it still like 550?
It's 417.
417.
Yeah.
So for folks that need more than $417,000 to close on the house, then they're going to go into the jumbo category.
Exactly.
Okay.
So
but it sounds like that's
it's not
up.
A big, you know, it's not a big jump in interest rates. So I mean, look, at the end of the day, the rates are still great. I mean, we got used
they
to
are.
That. You know, we saw those threes for a while, right? And now, you know, if you want to do a 5-1 or a 7-1 ARM, you can still possibly attain that kind of number. But, you know, I'm kind of a long-term buyer and holder, so I would, you know, 4.5 at 30 years is still unbelievable.
Still good money.
Yes.
You bet. Talk about Mike, your business, Park City Realty Group, is a niche brokerage. You don't have a lot of agents.
No.
The big guys in town have literally 100 plus agents. What's the advantage for you to stay small?
Well, the advantage is, you know, costs are huge once you start. You know, there's a threshold of maybe after 25, 30 agents, you know, I mean, your costs just go up tremendously with office space and just everything related to
all
to numbers. You know, and that said, we are looking to grow and grow responsibly and you know, kind of organically and really, you know, go after the community-based agent that's really heavily involved in the community. And that's kind of our mantra is, you know, community first. Even though we do have an international affiliation now, you know, it's always going to be Park City first, and that's the model of the agent we're looking for that truly is involved in the community as well as their real estate business.
Not someone who's going to jump in when it's hot and jump out when it's not.
We don't. We're not really advertising for part timers. We want somebody that's going to be involved in the business, and you know, I know myself. I mean, we're putting in 50 to 60 hours a week, and was working yesterday afternoon. And
it's a tough job.
It's a tough business, and you have to work really, really hard.
I mean, you're working. Your schedule really has to tie in when other people have time to go
exactly.
Look at houses. So you're working evenings and weekends, which can be tough on a family.
It can be very tough, and I you know, often miss some of my kids' sporting events and. You know, was done working on Saturday afternoon and jumped in the car and headed to Ogden Ice Sheet for an 8 o'clock hockey game. So it's a crazy time, but it's fun. And it can be a fun business, and with the improving market, it's
even funner.
Even funner, and it's becoming a happier business again, if I can say it that way.
Well, that's a good note to leave us on. It's becoming a happier business. It certainly feels happier out there. Mike, we appreciate you coming on. We appreciate your support of the station as well. We couldn't do many of the things we do at KPCW without good supporters like yourself and your team. Thank you.
Thank you, guys.
Appreciate you, Mike. And we'll be back to wrap up Mountain Money after this.
Juniper Landing is proud to support our local radio station, KPCW. Juniper Landing is a new, whole ownership townhome community located at the base of Canyons Resort, adjacent to the Waldorf Astoria Park City, with a model open daily. Our website is juniperlandingparkcity.com.
Additional funding for programming on KPCW has been provided by Longreimer Weiniger Bepler, Estate Planning, Family Law, lrw-law.com. Brett Stimson, Mortgage Assistant for Home Purchases, 801-201-3484. The Corporation for Public Broadcasting and listeners like you.
And welcome back to Mountain Money. And, you know, we were talking with Clint Probst, who started a funeral home in an old restaurant and sports bar location in Midway. And it reminded me that when I moved to Park City and I started coming in the 70s, made the move permanent in 1980, Open Mortuary in Heber built a brand new mortuary in Park City. And the timing was perfectly awful because the old timers had moved out and the town was new and nobody was dying. and they built this new facility. It's now a church on Kearns over by the yard. And they built it and there just weren't enough people dying. But now the demographics are certainly changing
score. That brings up a good point. One of the reasons I like talking to some of our guests is decisions are really important. You know, making the right decision. I mean, everything you just described there were things that mortuary probably could have looked at and said, you know, this is not the time to open this business in this location.
Yeah, exactly. You know, one piece of bright news that comes out every month, and it just gets better and better, Doug, is the January unemployment rate in Utah is now 3.9%. It's dropped under 4, and, you know, the national average is 6.6, something like that. So Utah continues to prosper.
And that's probably getting close to the low. You know, there is a natural low. There's a natural level of unemployment. It used to be considered 2.5-3%, and we're getting really close to that.
It's like our beer, 3.2%, something like that. So so thanks very much for joining us this morning for an interesting conversation about the world of business and leadership today. Yeah, check out the YouTube TED Talk of Simon Sinek. It has like 16 million views.
He was really good.
And interesting had some different takes on leadership than others. I want to thank our great sponsors, Park City Realty Group, Mountain West Bank, Iron Mountain Group, the Park City Chamber, Prudential Real Estate, and San Francisco Design. We couldn't do these shows without the support of great sponsors like those, and we appreciate having them. And Doug, it just gets better and better here in Utah in terms of strong economy.
And, you know, it looks like things are going to continue on this trend. You don't know what you don't know. There could be surprises. But, yeah, let's hope it continues. It looks like it probably will.
Very good. Well, thanks for joining us on Mountain Money. Thanks to Beth Fratkin for being our producer. And this is KPCW in Park City. Time for the news.